Chapter 18. They need our help. Coulter, you're with me, Sergeant Jaitz ordered as he flexed his powered legs and jumped upward out of the crater.
What about me?
Dave's own suit was flashing yellow warnings that the nanomotors and the legs were not operating at full capacity.
You and Jarrett remain here.
Jaitz steadied Jesse as that soldier landed heavily from his own leap out of the crater.
The transmitter must not be damaged, or this whole mission is for nothing.
But,
Dave began to protest.
Dave, cover me,
Shauna cut off the argument.
I'm a sitting duck down here.
Gotcha.
Dave readied his rifle and extended the sensor mast atop his helmet to pop up above the lip of the crater.
Quanpon, man. Vaya con Dios.
Take care of my girl,
Jesse answered without thinking.
Then there was no time for thought as he dashed after the Verdcrist soldier.
Sergeant Jaitz had a simple plan. Hit the truck and hit it hard. He knew from the TacLink sensor feed what the truck looked like and where it was, and he also knew from experience that an energy shield was weakest where it contacted the ground. The shield was designed to protect from threats above. It could not be strong everywhere.
Coulter, go right, he instructed as he came around a low building and caught a glimpse of the makeshift air defense vehicle.
As he turned to run straight at the truck, there was a loud whoosh sound accompanying the launch of two more missiles. Jaitz held his fire, knowing his maser beam and flechette rounds would only bounce off the shield and alert the enemy to his presence. When he was less than 30 meters from the target, a searing maser beam from above struck the shield, deflecting from the shield and blinding the sensors of Jaitz's suit for a long second. If he had been next to the truck when that beam struck, the backscatter would have boiled him alive despite the best efforts of the skin suit to protect him. He crouched to his knees behind an elevated pipe, shaking his head and blinking to clear his own innate senses as the suit's systems cycled through a restart. It took less than 2 seconds, during which time he was blind and exposed and useless, hoping the soldiers in the truck had been similarly blinded and unaware of his approach. The sensors came back on abruptly, blinking a yellow warning about the outer layer of the suit's shell being scorched and recommending him to be careful.
Be careful? In combat?
He snorted in a bitter laugh at the Ruhar suit designers. Then he was up and racing forward, leaping over the pipeline and gaining speed. To his right, he saw Sergeant Coulter closer to the truck and guessed that human had been masked from the maser blast by the building. Jaitz used his superior speed to reach the truck just before Jesse, gesturing for Jesse to get on the ground and roll like the Verdcrist did. As Jaitz hit the ground and rolled, his sensors went blind again, and he felt a fiery tingling like he was being bitten by thousands of poisonous ants. Then he was through the energy shield, and most of his sensors came back online. A quick glance upward revealed no Kristang looking down for threats on the ground. Jesse wriggled through the shield, coming to his knees and shaking his helmet before looking over to flash a thumbs-up gesture Jaitz had become familiar with. Jaitz pointed to the missile launcher box on the back of the truck above Jesse and spun to hop onto the truck frame behind the cab. Jesse did not need engraved instructions on what to do. He figured the situation called for blowing shit up and doing it right fucking now. His rifle was already selected for flechette rounds in armor-piercing mode. He held the weapon above his head to clear the big truck's frame rails and used the pop-up sensor mast of his helmet to get a clear view of the target. The Ruhar rifle did not have a full auto feature, so Jesse depressed the trigger button repeatedly to send 3-round bursts of flechettes into the swivel mount under the launcher box. The first 3 rounds penetrated the makeshift mount, locking it in place and skewing the box above. Subsequent rounds automatically switched themselves from armor-piercing to explosive mode based on sensor data from the suit's computer, and the tiny but powerful explosive-tipped flechettes ripped into the unarmored launcher box, tearing it apart like tissue paper and setting off the last 3 zingers. The truck rocked as the zinger motors were set off by the explosive energy, and the damaged missiles rocketed unguided out of their tubes to pinwheel across the sky. 1 zinger, so badly damaged to have its casing nearly cracked in half, broke apart while still in the launch tube. What remained of the launcher box was shredded, and then the missile's warhead exploded after it had thudded into the ground no more than 20 meters from the truck. The explosion knocked Jesse off his feet and sent him skidding across the ground past the front of the truck, his boots clipping a wheel along the way.
Jesse spun as he slid across the dusty ground, one arm firmly gripping the rifle, while the other flailing to halt his uncontrolled skid. The rifle was torn from his grip, and his helmet bashed into something hard. Jesse slumped in his suit as he rolled to a stop, blinking, and seeing only stars in his vision. Sergeant cursed words that could not be properly translated. He had been about to fire rounds into the truck's lightly armored cab when the explosion knocked him off his feet and he had fallen heavily to the ground on top of his rifle, cracking the casing of the weapon's control system. He tossed it away in disgust and extracted a sidearm as the truck's cab door creaked open and the muzzle of a Kristang rifle poked out, mercifully at a bad angle to target Jates. The Sergeant grasped the door with one glove and reached around to pump shots into the cab with his sidearm, emptying the weapon's 16-shot magazine, then tossing the spent pistol away to grasp the dead Kristang's rifle and haul it out of the cab. He no sooner held the rifle stock when it was shot out of his hands, the rounds coming from inside the cab. Reacting, he reached back for a grenade on his belt and tossed it into the cab, slamming the door closed and using his weight to hold it there until the grenade detonated and the door came flying off, Jates with it. He lay momentarily stunned on the ground before popping to his feet in a smoothly gymnastic move assisted by the skin suit's stabilizers, the top of his helmet crashing into something unseen and making him fall again. When he was able to roll onto one side, he saw a figure in Kristang hard armor facing him and holding its helmet with both hands, just as stunned as Jates. The rifle the figure had about to use to shoot Jates had gone flying away beyond reach, but farther from Jates. For a split second, both soldiers looked at the lost rifle, then each other, both judging they did not have the time to dive for the weapon. The Kristang reached behind his back for some type of weapon, so Jates did the only thing he could do. He launched himself through the air to tackle his opponent before the man armed himself. Too late. A pistol came around toward Jates, who survived only by ducking his head and using the top of his helmet to smash the other under the chin. The blow made them separate, and the pistol soared up onto the truck that was still rocking from many explosions. The Kristang howled, and an evil-looking knife appeared in one hand, having slid down from a sheath on his forearm. Holding the knife for slashing rather than stabbing, he held his other arm out wide and stepped sideways to trap Jates against the truck, so Jates responded by racing inside the man's guard and wrapping him in a crushing bear hug. The knife came down into Jates's back, where it snapped and slid away, just as the Verdcris had known it would, the skin suit having stiffened and produced a slippery hump in the area where the knife was projected to impact.
"Ruhar, weakling scum!"
the enemy soldier screamed, spittle flinging onto the side of his faceplate to drop down against the repulsor field. As they struggled, the enemy to break away and Jates to gain a grip on a weak area of his opponent, Jates eye-clicked his faceplate to go clear, and he was rewarded by a gasp and brief hesitation by the other man.
"I am no Ruhar," Jates grunted, using the all-too-brief moment of surprise to get both hands firmly around the other man's left arm. "I am true, Kristang." "Liar! Traitor!"
the opponent screamed, and used the full power of his hard-shell armor in a futile attempt to break free of the crushing grip exerted by the Ruhar skin suit's gloves.
"You are the traitor to our heritage."
Jates's words came out in a bubbling gasp as the two spun around and slammed each other repeatedly against the truck.
"You are slaves to the Ruhar."
"We are all slaves. My masters have better technology." Jates butted a shoulder under the man's chin, then pressed a knee on his chest, ordering his skin suit to exceed its safety limits. The two powered armor suits strained and whined, warning lights flashing in each visor, until Jates gave a mighty jerk backward and the enemy's left arm tore away at the weak shoulder joint in the armor, taking the flesh and bone limb with it. The soldier slumped backward as blood spurted out only briefly before a seal formed over the wound. Nanomachines injected into the man's spine kept him from going into shock. He actually tried to stand and face Jates defiantly. The Verdcris soldier viciously swung the torn armor limb like a club straight into his injured opponent's faceplate. Once, twice, three times, until the man went limp on the ground, and Jates finished him by stomping hard on the neck joint of the suit, snapping the bones beneath.
Holy shit!
Jesse was on one knee, his rifle barrel wavering as his vision had not cleared completely.
I couldn't get a clean shot, he explained.
It is finished.
Jates wriggled inside the skin suit, his real limbs and joints aching terribly from the strain. When the armored limb tore loose, his skin suit was using so much power, it almost popped Jates' shoulders out of their sockets.
You done torn his arm off and beat him to death with it.
Jesse's pupils were as big as they could get.
I mean, damn, I heard people say that before, but I never seen anybody do it.
Ignoring the human's comment, Jates turned away so he wouldn't show the pain on his face. He feared he had torn muscles, and I clicked to damp down the painkillers the suit was injecting into him. He couldn't afford the brain fuzziness that the painkillers sometimes caused.
My rifle is broken, he explained as he picked up the Kristang weapon.
Yeah.
Jesse carefully poked his head around the missing door to see the bloody carnage in the truck's cab. What was left of the missile launcher box had stopped shaking from explosions, and the flickering haze of the energy shield was gone, a fact Jesse verified by looking up at the shield projector dome above the cab. The dome was peppered by shrapnel, and sparks arced inside it.
Maybe we should get away from here, in case this thing's power cells blow.
Good, Jates gasped, falling to his knees. Idea.
Hey, man. Sergan, you okay?
I could. Jates swallowed his pride. Use assistance.
Yeah, sure thing.
Jesse knew how much that admission must have cost the proud warrior.
Up you go,
he said, not knowing what else to say. Jates put an arm around Jesse's shoulders, and Jesse carefully stood up to his full height. Then they took slow steps forward.
I feel like I got hit by that truck, Jates groaned.
Even if it makes you feel any better.
The after effect of combat making Jesse's accent thicker than molasses in January, as his grandpappy would say.
The other guy looks a lot worse.
He eye-clicked to open the tack link as they shuffled away from the truck quickly as possible.
Colonel Perkins, that truck is out of action. You copy?
Colonel.
He shared a frightened look with Jates.
Colonel. Anyone.
Irene had her full concentration simply on not crashing, as the big and awkward Dodo zoomed sickeningly between and just above buildings. One engine had been ejected by blowing explosive bolts where its pylon connected to the hull. The other engine was severely overheated. The rear control surfaces were sluggish from battle damage. The aft point defense maser turret was still rebooting, and they had an unknown number of missiles on their tail, none of which Irene could pay attention to at the moment. She had to focus on the most basic rule of aviation. Fly the aircraft. Everything else could and would have to wait or be handled by someone else, until Irene could get the dropship flying steady and not wobbling as if about to auger into the ground at any second. The asymmetric thrust from the one remaining engine was trying to flip the clumsy craft on its back. Derek forced himself to tear his eyes away from the cockpit display windows to ignore the sight of the ground that was right there as the dropship skidded across the sky tilted on its side. He poured emergency coolant into the overheated engine, wasting hours of precious coolant in seconds, and wishing the controls didn't keep warning him of the totally obvious dangers.
Yes, I know we are missing an engine. Thank you very much, you piece of shit.
The missile threat warning hooting annoyingly in his ear was also unnecessary.
Okay.
Irene felt her stomach muscles unclench painfully as the big dropship steadied at a 12-degree angle to the port side, and she was able to gain altitude in a controlled manner.
Not okay!
Derek couldn't wait any longer for the bulky topside aft maser turret to make up its mind and finish rebooting. The damn thing was stuck somewhere in its cycle. He guessed some physical component had been damaged and the point defense system was waiting for a reply that would never happen.
Yaw starboard 30 degrees, then roll us another 10 degrees to port.
Without asking why, Irene gently slewed the ship 30 degrees to the right without banking, in a cringe-inducingly un-aerodynamic maneuver. When the ship's nose was pointed in the designated direction, she rolled it even more to the left and held the course straight.
Doing it. Why? Topside aft PDS is offline. We need the belly cannon tracking inbounds,
Derek responded without looking up from his console.
Belly PDS has targets.
The maser turret on the underside of the ship reacted immediately when the bulk of the craft was no longer masking its line of sight to the four inbound missiles. The maser exciters got photons lined up coherently, and pulses of microwave energy lanced out in coordination with the forward topside turret, bracketing the closest missile and getting closer with each shot. With two masers working together quicker than the blink of an eye, the random side-to-side and up-and-down evasive jinking of the missile had to become less random to avoid running into a destructive beam. In less than a quarter second, the dropship's point defense system identified a pattern in the missile's attempts to evade being effectively targeted, and the next shot from the topside cannon was aimed slightly to the right and below the missile. The lead missile flew directly into the beam, and its warhead exploded. Having one less missile tracking them was great for the three humans and one Jirapha inside the dropship. The premature detonation of the warhead meant no shrapnel could catch the accelerating craft, and its PDS automatically switched focus to the second missile, and was confused for a crucial 0.4 seconds. The downside to the first missile exploding was that the Krestang weapons designers were not stupid, nor were they inexperienced at air combat. When the missile was hit by a maser beam, its tiny brain had a nanosecond to assess whether the hit was fatal, and the answer was yes, and then hell yes, as the propulsion motor began to break up from the maser energy. The second question was whether the missile was close enough to try for a proximity kill, and the answer was sadly no. So the missile's last act of defiance was to detonate its warhead in chaff mode, the explosive charge in a wide disc parallel to its direction of flight. Burning hot particles created a cloud that scorched the air, filled the area with powerful static, and temporarily blocked the dropship's view of the second missile. The second missile also was smart. It knew what the first missile had done and why, and even before it decrypted the final burst transmission from the doomed weapon, the second missile fired thrusters to slow itself and linger in the shadow of the cloud another 0.1 seconds before turning violently to the left and down. The second missile also had analyzed the target's defensive capability and tendencies and identified what it hoped was a weakness, so it intended to approach from a direction where only one maser turret could get a line-of-sight view. Derek recognized the danger even before the red light flashed on his console.
We lost target lock! We lost it!
The predictive software was warning the missile would impact in 3 seconds or less, and the point defense system still was searching the sky for that second missile. The display held three fuzzy pink objects that might be possible threats, with confidence too low for the PD cannons to fire. Even as Derek's brain formed the thought, to hell with that, and his fingers reached to override the PDS safeties so the damned maser turrets could fire at something, he knew anything he did would be too late.
Is there...
Irene asked to inquire if there was something she should be doing. Could be doing, when the Dodo rocked, and even more warning lights flared on the consoles. They had been struck from behind. Thank God it was a proximity blast, and not a direct hit. The aft belly turret was offline, and most systems behind the 17th structural frame were glitching, dead, or dead and on fire. That wasn't right. Zingers could shape their proximity warheads to direct the shrapnel in a cone toward the target. There should be a lot more damage. The tail should be shredded.
You hit the...
Thank you to Tula, Derek interrupted the pilot.
Welcome, the Verdcris woman replied tersely, having no time to chat as she flipped her relatively nimble fighter gunship into a tight turn.
Normally, bleeding off airspeed in combat is a surefire recipe for disaster, but she had no choice. With the other dropship missing an engine, trailing fire as random parts broke away and unable to defend itself unless its two forward point defense turrets got lucky, she had to cover it with her own cannons, and that meant flying slow and close. The idea of flying straight at the missiles and trying to shoot them with her more powerful but slow-reacting maser cannons was an idiotic scheme that would have washed her out of flight training before she could get herself killed. Being smart meant tucking her ship in behind the crippled dropship, trying to anticipate its movements, and trusting her Vulture's point defense system to do its job.
Her fighter had energy shields, but in flight they were useful only against directed energy weapons like maser and particle beams. Against missiles, unless she got very lucky by spoofing the enemy guidance systems at long range, it was kill or be killed, and even her enhanced reactions were far too slow to track an incoming missile. A glance at the point defense system monitor showed it was fully capable and ready for more action after having destroyed the second missile before it could hit Perkins's ship. Now it was a matter of one computer system matching against another. The missiles had the advantage of being small, stealthy, and ferociously maneuverable, and of tracking a large and slow-moving target. The dropship's maser cannons had the advantage of a stable platform to shoot from, their beams traveling at the speed of light and being able to cycle a kill shot every 0.3 seconds. Tutula hated relying on the cold logic of automated systems for her survival. The two remaining missiles in flight had no discomfort about relying on logic, as they had not been programmed to experience comfort, discomfort, or any other emotions. They had been expertly programmed to kill and to use cold, hard logic to accomplish that. Both missiles analyzed the situation, and when one missile made a suggestion that would require the sacrifice of the other, the suicidal missile did not hesitate. Instantly, the two separated, with one missile continuing to track the smaller target and jink toward it to evade maser fire, while the other missile dove down and went wide to kill the crippled target. The snap assessment had been that their best chance to make a kill was to hit the crippled ship rather than the nimble fighter gunship. If the suicidal missile could hit the fighter airspace craft, that would be great, but its purpose was to draw defensive fire away from its companion. The suicidal missile's brain recorded a maser beam near miss that was too close, and it calculated a 76% chance a maser would score a direct hit before it got close enough for even a proximity kill. So without any regret, it detonated its warhead in a shape charge directed at the fighter craft ahead of it. Tutula had no time for rejoicing, and no cause for celebration when the warhead blew by itself. Her fighter was caught in the shockwave and shrapnel pinged off the hull, making the defensive shield flare and fuzzing the view of the point defense sensors. The system attempted to lock on to the single remaining missile, cycling through several engagement solutions in nanoseconds, before concluding it could not be confident of an intercept before the missile struck the crippled Dodo dropship. It signaled that bad news to the pilot by flashing an orange light on a console. When Tutula saw the blinking light representing the depressing analysis of her point defense system, she did not shout out a useless warning. The missile was approaching from below and behind the other dropship, the vulnerable Dodo carrying the mission commander and the Giraptha who was needed to extract data from the research core. The data that was needed to save the lives of humans on the planet they called Paradise, and more importantly, to safeguard the lives of Ruhar on that planet and beyond. Saving lives was why she dedicated her life toward training hard to qualify for star duty. Saving lives was really only a secondary objective, but at the moment, saving the lives aboard the other dropship aligned perfectly with her primary mission. Tutula kicked the throttles to maximum and pushed the nose down, straight into the path of the missile. If the missile was startled by the good fortune of scoring a direct impact on a fighter gunship rather than an already damaged target, it made no comment as it altered course slightly. At that angle, it could not have hit the larger dropship anyway. So it pushed through the Vulture's ineffective energy shield, plunging through the lightly armored skin above the portside wing and shattering a maser cannon before it struck something solid enough to set off its warhead.
Holy shit, Derek gulped, his throat constricting, so he choked on the words. Get us out of here. On the deck.
Missile status? Perkins asked as Irene dipped the nose and built up airspeed, confused by what her tactical display was showing her.
No birds in the air, Derek reported with an anguished look shared between the pilots.
We got it? Perkins asked with a shudder of relief, unaware she had been holding her breath.
No, ma'am, Irene responded for Derek, who was too badly shaken and focusing his attention on keeping their one engine running.
Tutula flew right into the path of that last missile. She saved us, ma'am.
I didn't... Perkins blinked away tears that suddenly formed, angry at herself for weakness in combat and for not understanding what the Verdcris pilot had done.
Can we...
She was interrupted by a call over the TAC link.
Colonel Perkins, that truck is out of action. You copy? Colonel. Colonel. Anyone.
The interruption brought her back to focus. She could mourn later.
Sergeant Coulter, what is your status?
We busted that truck up good.
Jesse's thick accent had toned down a bit as his heart rate slowed.
Shauna and Dave are guarding the sensor transmitter. We're okay down here. Sergeant Jates took a pounding.
I am fully effective, Jates protested. Colonel Perkins, I suggest my team search the base for opposition before you land. Can you provide air support?
Negative on the air support.
Perkins did not elaborate.
Jates, secure the transmitter ASAP and clear the area around the research compound. We can land between buildings there.
If Jates had a bad feeling about why no air support was available, he did not say anything. The ground team first sprayed a fast-setting foam around the transmitter, then partly filled in the crater to bury it, placing the ceramic block on top. The four then rushed over to the research base and cleared the compound building by building as quickly as they could, a task simplified by the fact the research section only contained three buildings. When Jates gave the all-clear, the big dropship came in low from the north, tucking itself between two buildings and awkwardly set down in a choking cloud of dust. The back ramp was already open, Arlen Dahl stepping nimbly out on his four legs as the craft settled on its landing skids. Perkins was right behind the Giraptha.
Sergeant Jates,
I already know, he replied stiffly.
I'm sorry. She sacrificed herself to save us, to save the lives on Paradise.
Excuse me, Colonel Perkins, but that is not why Tutula acted. Not why I am here. We serve the Ruhar to save our own people from slavery, to rescue our culture from extinction. I think in that way, my people and yours have something very important in common. To the surprise of Emily Perkins, the hulking alien in the dirty and scratched skin suit offered her a fist bump. While that was not proper military protocol, it was a heartfelt gesture, and she graciously accepted.
Sergeant Jates, can you escort Arlen Dahl to the research corps?
Jarrett, go with them, she added without waiting for Jates to reply.
Chaika, Coulter, go see what those asshole keepers are doing. I don't want any interference from them.